The leading international body for the assessment of climate change, better known as the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, recently reported that we have about 12 years to get our act together as a civilization. From my perspective, it is the alarm bell I've been waiting for. It's the research I have needed to make sure I know that I'm sending the right message. So who is going to effectively lead the charge to organize people to fight for the environment? Enter Green Corps. Green Corps is the country's most respected training program for environmental organizers, with nearly 400 of their graduates at work today on the most urgent environmental issues of our time. They train people who are passionate about the environment and ready to learn and practice the craft of organizing. Get ready to learn how to harness the power of organizing. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. And can you believe that we're already 1 month into the new year? Hopefully, all of us are standing strong in our commitment to step up our game when it comes to protecting this great planet of ours. And as you all know, the opportunities to do that are many. Our guest for this next hour will be helping all of us in our journey as she is leading a significant movement that is helping to change the landscape of our country and, in turn, our planet. Please join me in welcoming our guest for this next hour, Annie Sanders, the Executive Director of Green Corps. Welcome, Annie. We did it. We connected, and I'm so excited about the show. It's great to have you with us. And we're very eager to hear all that you have to say about Green Corps and the important work you're doing.
Great. Thank you for having me.
So let's start with the most obvious. Tell us about the Green Corps program and how it works.
Absolutely. So the mission of Green Corps is to train organizers, provide field support for today's critical environmental campaigns, and graduate activists who possess the skills, temperament, and commitment to fight and win tomorrow's environmental battles. We were started in 1992 as a field school for environmental organizing to train people who were ready to do whatever it would take to fight for the planet that we love. And we've really taken on this challenge to train the next generation of environmental leaders over our 27-year history. So our year-long field school for environmental organizing combines 8 weeks of intensive classroom training with multiple campaign efforts, wherein trainees gain hands-on experience running environmental field campaigns with leading environmental organizations. So groups like the Wilderness Society, Mighty Earth, Audubon Society, Climate Reality Project, and more. And then at the end of the program, Green Corps facilitates the placement of our organizers into permanent positions with leading environmental groups around the country.
That's a lot. And, you know, it's to me, in terms of your credibility, I always want to add more about the guests, because there is something really critical for I think, the message to go out that your background, your job is you fundraise from foundations, major donors, and grassroots members. You manage Green Corps' recruitment director and organizing directors. But then it's important for me to share with people your background, because you were the associate director for 2 years, an organizing director for Green Corps for 3 years, and an assistant organizing director for 4 years. And somehow for me, coming up through the ranks, you know how it all works. You could see what holes there were or what really worked. And in addition to that, you have directed field efforts on behalf of some pretty powerful organizations, many of whom have been guests on the show, like Food and Water Watch, the Natural Resources Defense Council, and then Fair Share Alliance and the National Wildlife Federation, among others. And prior to that, you were a student activist, an athlete at the University of Chicago. It just made me smile reading all this. And you have a degree in environmental studies, and you graduated from Green Corps in 2007. So now here you are. So thanks for all your great work up to including right now. So
absolutely.
I've got questions about diving a little bit deeper into learning skills from environmental leaders. And my one question is, does Bill McGibbon really participate in the training? He's hard to get these days, but has he still stayed in? This is a dream of mine. We haven't gotten him yet.
Oh, he joins us almost every year. He was actually joining us at our December training a few weeks ago. So we Skype him in. He usually stays at home in his Vermont office and in his home, but he Skypes in almost every year to Green Corps training. And it's a really inspiring speaker to have for young organizers how to do this work.
He is the founder of 350.org, for those of you who might not be aware of it. And again, his name is Bill McGibbon. And he is a very big deal in terms of environmental leadership and the environmental movement. So check out 350.org. So you said you do hands-on experience in real campaigns. So you train the people enrolled in the program, and then you actually put them out and have them do field work with help, assistance, oversight. How does that work?
Yes, exactly. So they attend a three-week introductory training in August. And most of these folks are recent college graduates from schools all across the country. So young 20-somethings who are passionate, motivated, and excited to work hard, hit the ground running to both learn the skills of organizing and then really make a difference on real environmental campaigns with groups around the country. So they, after the 3 weeks of introductory training, launch out into the field in cities ranging from Bangor, Maine to St. Petersburg, Florida, LA, Chicago, Minneapolis, Fayetteville, Arkansas, and everywhere in between, to work with these organizations who have essentially hired Green Corps to run their field campaigns. So we put together a campaign plan with the leadership of those organizations and essentially come up with what we think it'll take to win on any number of issues. So for example, right now we're working on a campaign in Arkansas with Audubon Arkansas to pass a statewide solar access bill. We're also working in Colorado with a group called Conservation Colorado to pass a carbon limit, which would be one of the strongest measures that any state's taken to combat climate change outside of, you know, California, Massachusetts, and some of the coastal states. So we essentially give them the training in the classroom that they need to go out there and actually build up a campaign from the ground in partnership with a local environmental organization.
So when you, I'm very interested in terms of actually some of the content. Do you have to train them about things like, if it involves like marching, for example, and I'm not sure if it does, are there things that you have to really train them about to be cautious of, to be aware of, potential dangers or whatever? Do you have to, what kind of things are involved in the curriculum?
Great question. We cover 18 skills modules in our August training.
Wow.
So those, yeah, it's a lot. We pack a lot into the three weeks. And so those are skills such as recruiting volunteers, training volunteers, developing them as leaders. We also train organizers on how to work with the media and gain media coverage for an event or a campaign. We train them on how to build coalitions. We also train them on skills like fundraising, digital organizing, time management and planning, as well as campaign development and messaging. So it really runs the gamut, and we build on those 18 skills modules throughout the rest of the year at 5 discrete week-long trainings that we intersperse with the field campaigns over the course of the rest of the year.
So it's pretty comprehensive in scope. I mean, there's a lot of moving parts to this, and I'm sure would change depending upon what the issue is. And, you know, you mentioned Colorado. Talk about a... they have like multi-personality disorder. I'm not trying to be mean because I love Colorado and we're going there a lot more because of family. And I love it in terms of the beauty of the state. But there really are, you know, I did my climate reality training with Al Gore in Denver. And it's like there's the rabid environmental leadership. And then there's a fair share of conservatives that are not buying into this, you know, fighting what I would call the good fight, obviously, but it's got to be a very interesting state to work in.
It is. I mean, it's a purple state still, even though it's been trending bluer over the last decade or so. I mean, it went for Obama in 2008 and in 2012 pretty solidly, and then again for Clinton in 2016. But before those presidential elections, it was much purpler and wasn't by any means a guaranteed, you know, blue or red state in either column. And so it's been an interesting evolution the state's undergone in the last you know, 10, 15 years or so, as more and more people have moved there, especially younger people with more liberal politics, honestly. And it is such a beautiful state. I mean, the mountains are right there. Oh. It's sunny 300 days a year. And it's just, it's an incredible place to be outdoors. And I think that really makes people confront the issue of environmental protection and kind of forces people to engage in a way, or at least think about it, whereas they might not in another state that's, you know, less bold in terms of its, right, its beauty.
And talk about places where you can very easily connect with nature. It's just outside the front door. I mean, it's pretty, right, amazing state. So sometimes this question, I think, when I was in mental health services, this question used to annoy me because it was, people would ask us about recidivism rates. And for our clients, when we were working with like youth corrections, and I'd say, you know, we don't have the funding to track what happens to all of our clients. We're too busy helping the ones we have. But I wonder if you have the ability to assess, even without like a big body of research, does this become a career path for lots of your graduates? Do they go forth and conquer and apply their skills in other organizations? Do you have a sense for that?
Yes, we definitely do. And honestly, that's, I think, the biggest contribution we make to the environmental movement. I mean, certainly we make a big impact on the campaigns that our organizers work on throughout their year. But to have 400 graduates of the Green Corps program over the course of the last 27 years is pretty impressive. And a lot of those folks have gone on to take on leadership positions with prominent environmental and social change groups. So, for example, Phil Radford is a Green Corps graduate from the class, I think, of 1999 or 2000. He is the former executive director of Greenpeace USA and is a pretty major leader in the movement. Folks like Greg Small, who's the executive director of a group called Climate Solutions out in Washington State. He's the, right, Green Corps class of, 1994. Layla Salazar Lopez, who is the executive director of Amazon Watch.
Love Layla. Right. Had her on the show.
Yes, she's great. She's a Green Corps graduate from the class of 97. And then we have folks like Bernadette Del Chiaro, who runs the California Solar and Storage Association out in the Bay Area, Sacramento. She's a Green Corps grad from 98. So we've got a lot of folks who went through our program in the 90s who are now at the helm of a lot of major environmental and social change groups.
And big deals, yes.
Yeah, big deals. And then a lot of our more recent alum are in major positions of leadership as well. So folks like Samantha Lockhart, who's the National Campaigns Manager with the National Wildlife Federation, Adam Collette, who's the Program Director with a group called Dogwood Alliance, Megan Rising is the Energy Campaign Manager at the Union of Concerned Scientists. These are all folks who went through the program in the last 10, 20 years, who are also helping to move the whole environmental and social change movement forward in a really strategic way.
And what's wonderful about that is our show producer, the wonderful Kelly King, will be listening to some of those names, and I might be sending you a text saying, Annie, guess who's going to be on our show in May? Because mentioned them. And Layla, it's a pretty funny story. I've had her on the show. I've spent some time with her. The Amazon rainforest got me started. And I was, just picture this, I'm at the National Climate Summit, the Climate Summit in San Francisco, the very first one of its kind, right? And I'm walking down the street in San Francisco, just walking. And I hear, Gina, it is just not something you expect. And I turn around and it was Layla. So I went to the, you know, she had a lot of indigenous people from Ecuador there. So I went to some of their presentation, but I digress, which is very much like me. Do you help find Green Corps experienced graduates? Do you help them with placement?
Yes, we do. That is what we usually talk about as the third component of our program. So the first component is classroom training. We provide 8 weeks of intensive classroom training on those 18 skills modules I mentioned. The second component is the field campaigns. And so we have our organizers for most of the year in the field working on real environmental campaigns in partnership with state, local, and federal, you know, nonprofits. And then the third part of the program is career placement. So we help organizers find a job within the broader environmental and social change field after they graduate from Green Corps. And we're pretty hands-on in that. We'll start talking to organizers about their next steps in February. They graduate in August, so it's a good 6 months in advance of the time they'll need to start getting another job. But we help them with writing their resume. We review cover letters. We train them on how to do informational interviews as well as actual interviews with prospective employers. And then I am pretty proactive about connecting organizers to our alumni and other contacts that I have within the broader movement who I think they'd learn a lot from or might be interested in talking to or learning from or potentially working for that person's organization down the line.
And I would think that, and one should never assume, but given your national reputation, that there are also organizations that reach out to you and say, "We've got this job opening. Can you help us? Can you send us a rock star?" So it cuts both ways.
Absolutely. I actually send out a jobs bulletin every few weeks or so to our alumni community with job postings that come across my desk from alumni and other folks who are looking for well-qualified organizers, advocates, and leaders to fill their positions. So it definitely works both ways.
So in terms of both ways, perfect segue, you did mention that states actually hire you to come in and apply all of the skills around a certain campaign. Other than that, do you also, I wanted to say, you know, do you pick the fight? Which battles, and I'm trying to stay positive, but which battles or issues? There are so many in these current times, especially in our country. How do you and your team decide where to put your energy and resources, which are not unlimited? How do you decide where to go?
Absolutely. And that's a great question and one that we think about a lot. And I'll just quickly clarify something first, which is that it's not states that hire us, but organizations.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, that work at both the statewide level, federal level, and local level that hire us. And in terms of how we pick the issues or groups to work with, we look for two main factors when we're considering which campaigns to work on. We look for organizations that are doing really critical work that we think is impactful and strategic, and where we think also that our organizers will be able to learn a lot and have a good experience on the ground actually running the campaign. So those are the two main factors: organizer experience and impact. And in terms of the specific issue area within impact, I mean, that's a pretty broad term. Obviously, climate change is the big kahuna, I would say. It's the most pressing environmental issue, I think, that we face. And a lot of other issues can be tied to it. And so we certainly prioritize campaigns that we think will have an impact on mitigating climate change. That being said, we're not a climate group exclusively. And so while we do, I think, favor campaigns that do have some impact on climate change, we also look at other issues that are profound, like protecting our oceans from offshore drilling, which is related to climate change, or from overfishing or plastic pollution. We also work on issues that have to do with reforming our food system and making it more sustainable. Again, also linked to climate change, but the thrust of that issue is really more around sustainable food systems. And so we take a look at all the issues on the table, all the organizations that are interested in hiring a field team, and make decisions based on where we specifically can have the biggest impact given our field resources and which campaigns we think will be the best training experience for our organizers.
So let's talk a minute about solutions. And I just have to comment here, as I'm fully listening, it's one of the things I love about Green Corps, because it's a systemic integrated approach. It's not one issue. It's the planet. When people have told me in the past, you should specialize more and focus on certain areas, and I say, I do. And they say, what are they? And I say, the planet, because it's all connected. So I love in your answer, yeah, this is related to climate change, and this is related to climate change, and so is this. It's not a silo, and there wasn't one solution. But in terms of solution, there are a lot of solutions out there for environmental problems. And of course, thank you, Paul Hawken and the Project Drawdown team, for putting an enormous, impactful outline or body of work of those proven solutions in energy conservation, renewable power, public lands, you know, protecting wilderness and wildlife, not extracting fossil fuels, the list goes on, greener ways of living. What do we need more of? That's a tough question, Annie, but with your experience and your spot, what do we need more of?
That's a great question. I think at the end of the day, we need more organizing. This may seem pretty obvious to Mrs. Green's World listeners, but I think it's worth, you know, talking about why we choose to organize as an approach to solving environmental problems. We think, first off, that organizing is the most effective way to make an impact on the most pressing environmental issues of the day. there are a lot of ways one can work on environmental issues, like environmental law, lifestyle activism, environmental education, research and technology, etc. We think all of those approaches are really important, but because we see environmental problems as political at their core, we pursue organizing. We think there are plenty of solutions just waiting to be implemented, and the reason they're not most of the time is not because we lack the facts or because the public wouldn't want to see action, but because there are special interests that don't want those policies put into place and work hard to maintain the status quo, which drowns out the voices of everyday people. But every decision maker, at the end of the day, is accountable to their constituents, and so we work to organize people to force decision makers to do the right thing for our environment. So that's one answer that I have for you, which is that we need more organizing.
No, but it's a great answer.
Yeah, and I think that's why we do what we do. We're not a research organization, although that is an important facet of the environmental movement. We don't do environmental education, though I'm glad that those groups exist because I'm certainly a product of good environmental education when I was younger. But at this point, we have such a limited time frame and we need action now, and progress is primarily being blocked by politics. So we need more organizing.
Yeah, there's that. And so perfect segue. We didn't rehearse this, everybody, but let's talk about one of our hashtags for Mrs. Green's World for this year is going to be hashtag 12 years to change. And as you know, two comprehensive reports were released late last year, one being the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which I believe, and I'm trying to make sure that I'm saying it right and that it's not fake news, I think it's the most comprehensive report ever published on the issue of climate change. And I can't find, I mean, the number of scientists, the amount of research papers, the contributors, it was a big deal. And the other, shockingly, was the White House's National Climate Assessment Report, which came out in November. And basically, the IPCC report said that we have about 12 years to change, 12 years to dramatically, drastically reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, or the consequences will be what I would say catastrophic, and I don't think that's being dramatic. We'll be at a point of no return for a very long time. And the White House report was equally bleak. I was very happily surprised. I couldn't find any good news in it. It was mostly a lot of warnings. And from where I sit, that puts a huge, even more urgent spotlight on the work you're doing. No pressure, Annie. Seriously, it's like, yeah, up the bar. So the two-part question is, did the content of either of those reports impact the work you're doing in terms of areas of focus, or do you think we've got this one, we just have to keep on doing what we're doing? What kind of impact did that have other than a big grin on everyone's faces and saying, yeah, I knew that?
Good question. I don't think that it was anything we didn't already know. I mean, certainly there were new facts and figures,
but
we all knew climate change was dire.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot of news. Soon. There was just a lot more proof.
Right, a lot more proof, which hopefully, I mean, it was helpful in terms of convincing, hopefully, more of the general public that we need to act. And it's always helpful to have more visibility and coverage of climate change as an issue. And so in terms of our efforts to mobilize public support and, you know, just shift public opinion on the issue of climate change, it was probably helpful. But ultimately, we need a big shift in hearts and minds. And that's honestly, I think, only going to come from more disasters that make people really confront the reality that climate change is having real and devastating impacts now and in your backyard. And or we need more reports and coverage and people talking about this issue, however that manifests. And so I think it was helpful. It wasn't anything new per se in terms of, you know, the fact that climate change is dire, but I think it was helpful in moving the debate forward. And in the 12-year time frame, I think, is always the time frame in general is always a helpful factor to be able to include when you're talking to folks about these issues, because it really forces some urgency, even as if there weren't enough urgency already. But the 12-year timeline really, really puts the issue in stark relief. And so we've got a limited amount of time. We've got a lot of work to do. We know what the solutions are. And so I think it just underscores the urgency of people getting involved, whether it's in Green Corps or in their local environmental groups or campaigns. I think hopefully some some folks had a fire lit under them in a way that they hadn't before. And we just need more of that to continue getting people involved.
And the research is positive sometimes in terms of more and more people getting on board and becoming believers. I'm like, well, you're a little late to the party, but you're welcome. And, you know, speaking of critical, one of my team pointed out a clip in the last day or so that I think was in Vox, and the writer said something to the effect that the IPCC report puts the alarm bell going off in approximately 12 years. And he said, it's been 3 months since the report was issued, which means about 2% of that time has already passed. So you know our time is now. You know the urgency. Your team knows it. How do you train teams so that they have a sense of urgency, but the focus is really on what you can do now? Because running around like Chicken Little, which I did write a newsletter article, said that I am Henny Penny. I am that person. I'm running around saying, the sky is falling. But the good news is we can pick it up. How do you train them? Does that make sense? Like, how do you, they have to have a sense of both, in my opinion, but can't go out with an alarm bell, because then everybody, you know, shuts off and closes the door and slams it in their face. How do you do that?
Right. Because that's not effective organizing.
No, it isn't. It doesn't help anybody. You have to have those little breakdowns in your privacy of your own home.
Right, exactly. That's a great question, because I think a lot of people feel hopeless or helpless in the face of such a cataclysmic global disaster. But you're right in saying that there are things we can do. There is progress to be made. There are concrete, tangible steps to take. And that's what we at Green Corps work to identify with our partner organizations and then mobilize our troops, as it were, to get out and actually make concrete, tangible progress on those campaigns. So, for example, as I mentioned earlier, the Colorado campaign is a really great instance of a very specific bill in a specific state that we can pass this session, because we've got control of the House, the Senate, and the governorship in terms of a pro-environmental majority. We've got the cards on our side in terms of being able to pass really bold climate legislation. And so we've got to act now. And we have a huge opportunity in Colorado where we can channel that angst and that energy and that worry and that concern into a real winnable campaign.
Into impact, yes.
And impact in a specific context. And so that's why we decided to work with Conservation Colorado, because we saw that this was strategic, this was winnable, and really could not only make an impact in terms of reducing Colorado's carbon emissions, but could really set a standard for the rest of the country in inland states that, you know, may not have thought that they could do something like this. But hey, if Colorado can do it, why don't we try the same thing?
Right. And it's just, I mean, it's another interview, but the policy debate is one that I'm very interested in, because I don't believe that some things can change with just all of us doing the right thing as citizens. I think that public policy changes are just absolutely critical in the days, weeks, and months to come. I think about Peter Pan and that crocodile that always made you nervous because it's ticking and it's getting closer. We cover a lot of sometimes daunting and sometimes depressing and alarming topics. We choose to do that because we want to raise people's environmental IQ or get them excited or engaged. But we really do love to hear about good news stories, people fighting the good fight, organizations like yours. So share with us a couple of, like, maybe some big victories in 2018 that gave you hope and that you celebrate the good news.
Absolutely. And there are plenty of them. I'll talk about one campaign that we ran and ultimately won in 2018. And it was a campaign that we worked on in partnership with a group called Mighty Earth, which is a great name. They are a global environmental campaign organization actually run by a Green Corps alumnus, Glenn Hurwitz, from class of 2002. Yeah. So we had seven organizers working on a campaign with Mighty Earth in the fall of 2017. We launched their campaign to get Tyson Foods to clean up their meat. What does that actually mean?
Goodness.
Yeah. So they are one of the country's biggest meat producers, and they have a lot of unsustainable practices that they support both directly and indirectly.
To say the least.
to say the least. Right, exactly. And so we, with Mighty Earth, targeted Tyson to get them to commit publicly to implementing some significant sustainability measures throughout their supply chain, ultimately so that pollution from the farms that grow the corn and soy that our meat eats, so that pollution from those farms does not get into our waterways, run down the Mississippi River and out into the Gulf, where, in fact, in 2017, at the time, it had created the largest dead zone in U.S. history, which is an area in the Gulf about the size of New Jersey where nothing can survive.
And it's a dead zone. I mean, there's no life in it. It's just water.
No life.
Right. It's dead, like exactly. Literally dead.
Exactly. And it's terrible for not only the ecosystems and environments there, but also for local fishing communities and commercial efforts in the Gulf that rely on a healthy Gulf ecosystem. So a whole host of problems associated with massive industrial agricultural pollution in the Midwest, and much of that coming from Tyson-related facilities. So our task was to organize throughout the Midwest mostly and convince Tyson Foods that they needed to change their practices and actually take the lead and transform into a more sustainable company, which is a challenging task. Fortunately,
that's
they
like
had
climbing done. The Mount Everest, because they're huge. They have lots of money, lots and lots of money and power. So exactly. It's David and Goliath in some sense.
Mm-hmm. A lot of our campaigns are David and Goliath, but there's a reason that story has withstood the test of time.
Because David won.
Exactly.
Right.
We know it's possible. And so we took on Tyson, and we had organizers based in Dallas, Texas, in Fayetteville, Arkansas, which is Tyson's headquarters. We had an organizer in Chicago, which is another big headquarters for them. We had somebody in Des Moines and also in New Orleans talking about the impacts of the runoff. And we also had an organizer in Omaha, Nebraska. So we were all over the Midwest, and we built up a really exciting campaign. So people really resonated with this story. And it was in large part because they know how bad the pollution is, especially in the Midwest when it's right in their backyard. They know that big agribusinesses like Tyson are to blame. And they know that if there's enough of them who come together to demand change, that they can, in fact, make a difference. And they can change the practices of even a Goliath like Tyson. And so we organized news conferences, we released reports, we got thousands of petitions signed, we signed on hundreds of local coalition partners in these communities all across the heartland, and ultimately culminated the campaign with a series of events in November that were forums and panel discussions that turned out hundreds more people to learn about the issue. Tyson responded. They were not happy. And we decided to continue the campaign into the spring of 2018. So we employed a lot of the same tactics, but stepped it up in terms of social media posts, calls generated directly into their headquarters, more media events. And finally, on April 5th, I believe, early April 2018, Tyson came out with a public statement and commitment saying that they would implement some significant sustainability measures on over 2 million acres of grain, which is over half of their U.S. supply chain. So it was a pretty big victory. Certainly not an entire victory because it wasn't their entire supply chain, but half of it is pretty darn impressive.
And huge.
It was a really exciting step forward in terms of protecting our waterways, public health, and making an impact on Big Ag's contribution to climate change.
Were there any videos released of you and your team doing the happy dance when that happened? It's like, that would go viral because I want to do the happy dance right now. It's a corporate giant.
Right.
And you got them to budge. And you got that. I think that's significant. I think it's more than a budge. It's very good news. And their commercials crack me up. I mean, it's like, yeah, if you drink that Kool-Aid, you're drinking the wrong Kool-Aid, and it could come out to haunt you. But one of the things that I'm feeling when you're having this, you know, sharing this with us, is that people really, there's common ground, because whether you're a Democrat or Republican, and anything I can ever do to take it out of the political arena, mm-hmm. I think is a really important thing to realize. Most common folk like me, decent people, they care about clean water. They care about if it really stinks to high heaven in their neighborhood, and they know they're breathing it and their kids are breathing it. So it's across all political lines. It's for the greater good. And even if there wasn't climate change, it's the right thing to do. We shouldn't be polluting our waterways. So it's like, yeah, right. Whether you believe it or not, don't you want a planet that's healthier? So right. It's just, that's a great example. And thank you so much for sharing that. So what, you mentioned some of the campaigns like going on in Colorado, but are there any major focus areas that are jumping out for 2019? Like what's cooking for 2019 so I can have you back early in 2020 and say, Gina, we did that one.
That is a great question. One of the unique aspects of our program is that we don't usually lock in our campaigns until relatively late in the game, as right. in close to right before they launch.
Right.
And that's because, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty, A, in our political climate right now. And then B, a lot of groups don't exactly know their plans or what their funding situation will be like or what they'll want to prioritize in the fall. If I'm thinking about, all right, what do I want to work on as a Green Core campaign for the fall of 2019? A lot of groups don't quite have their plans fully fleshed out at this point for the summer or the fall. And so we wait until a little bit closer to campaign launch before we lock in our partners. But I do think that, you know, just to your earlier point, it is really important in this time of political strife and division and heightened rhetoric to be able to bring people together around yes. issues where they really can find common yes. ground. And I think the environment is really strategic to work on because everybody's a stakeholder. As you say, at the end of the day, environmental issues are so strategic to organize around because although they certainly impact some communities more deeply than others, they affect literally everyone, no matter your race, your gender, your socioeconomic status, or your political affiliation. Clean air, clean water, and a livable climate should not be partisan, and we can all agree on them. And the public is with us. In poll after poll, 70% of Americans support stronger environmental protections.
Yes.
70%.
Yes, over and over and over, over and over. That's the majority, people. 70% is the majority. Right.
Nobody agrees on anything, 70%. I mean, that's really impressive.
It's true.
And, you know, people obviously want a clean environment, but the way the system is set up, the majority doesn't really get to make most of those decisions. Instead, those with power, special interests, large corporations, unaccountable politicians have an outsized influence on the future of elephants or whether our water is drinkable or whether we'll have solar energy versus coal-fired power plants. And if we separate the powerful individuals and corporations who are responsible for environmental problems from everyone who is affected by their pollution, it becomes pretty clear what's going on. So the real strategic value of organizing people around environmental issues is that it presents a fundamentally radical way of addressing the distribution of power in this country. It divides the pro-environmental public against unaccountable special interests that are wrecking our planet. And when I think about future campaigns and what 2019 will bring, I'm looking for opportunities that'll draw that bright line in the sand and can ultimately shift the balance of power in this country.
Bam. I want to just say bam. There it is. It's like, yes, now I'm doing the happy dance. So let's segue into the power of partnerships, because there certainly is a really strong case to be made for strength in numbers, safety in numbers. And Green Core is a great partner, and you're part of the Public Interest Network, which is a group of organizations that obviously share your vision for a better future. They have core values that align with yours, and they have strategic approaches that would also be compatible with making positive changes like you do. So tell us about that network and your involvement with them. I think it's an important question.
Yes. So we were founded by the Public Interest Research Group in 1992. And so that was shortly after Earth Day 1990, which was a sort of reboot, as I understand it, of Earth Day 1970, which was the original big Earth Day, as I'm sure you know better than I. And 1990 was a big year for environmental issues. And coming out of that, there was clearly a ton of energy and excitement and momentum around working on environmental issues, but there was no training program for young people who wanted to get into this kind of work professionally. So Green Core was founded by the PIRGs, as they're called, to fill that gap and bridge the gap between the young, passionate masses who wanted to work on environmental issues for
right.
a career and the professional, you know, nonprofit organizations that were looking for skilled, trained staff. And so U.S. PERC put down about $1 million to get us off the ground, which we have since paid back in full.
Wow.
And we're, you know, part of the broader public interest network, which includes U.S. PERC, Environment America, groups like Environmental Action, Toxics Action Center, and many more who are all working on environmental and public interest issues in many different ways in states all across the country.
And partnerships are so important. I mean, it is just really wonderful when I see that, and I think it's the wave of the future. Even in the local communities, we're working on that a lot in Arizona, of strategic alliances that really bring about greater change. So now there's a fun question, and it's the honest to God truth, and I hope it'll give you a chuckle. So when I was prepping for the show, I remembered that I did a show a long time ago, maybe 5 or 6 years, with one of my daughter's friends, and her name is Emma Greenbaum, and I think she's at Yale right now. She went through
Green Coral, 2012.
Oh my God, I can't believe you know that. Wait till I tell my daughter Emily, and I'll tell Emma too. It's like, so.
Yeah, please do.
I will. Green Coral, 2012. It just blows me away that you remember that. So she went through the training. At that time, I obviously spent time and did some research. But what I didn't pick up on is the demographics are of the people you train. So I was thinking, I'm sitting there thinking, wow, you know, at some point, this would be something, this is where the laughter comes in, that I would like to do someday, to go through this training and get the full track. And you know, my life's pretty full right now trying to preserve the planet. And then I saw the group picture where the average age is about 12. It looked like it was about 12. And I thought, I could be, you know, early 20s. And I said, I could be the grandmother, or maybe even the great-grandmother of the group. So you are working with young people, and I respect it. I agree with it. I admire it. So here's a just thoughtful question. Given the millions of retired people in our country who still want to be relevant, who still want to be engaged in the business of making a difference, and there are more and more of us every day. I have so many friends that say, retirement, what the heck would that look like? Where would you tell us to go? What are some of the organizations that need our help and expertise? Do you have any thoughts on that? Like, where do the elders go for this kind of thing? Climate reality training is one, all ages, but that's not as focused and as strategic and as so impactful as yours. What's your read on that? Because you have a lot of experience with different organizations. What are you telling us to do?
That is such a great question. And honestly, I'm going to tell you a story, which is, I think, funny, but maybe not. During one of our week-long trainings, I think this was February of 2009, maybe, or 2010, we were running a training, and somebody just had the idea, you know what? What if we started Gray Corps? Green Corps.
Oh my God, I love it. I think it's very funny. And I love it. Sign me up.
You know, you're totally right. There's a total
gap
in the environmental movement that's not engaging as well as we could. People who are, you know, retired, who have the time to devote to these kinds of issues and in running campaigns, but there's nowhere they can get real focused training. And so we kind of came up with the idea and used it as an example in one of our trainings for a number of years. You know, we don't have the resources to start it, but gosh, would I love to. And I hope somebody does someday.
I hope somebody's listening and my phone rings and say, hey, I'm here. I've got the $1 million. Do you want to help me get this launched? And you'll be the second phone call.
Great. I'm happy to share our trainings if that gets off the ground. So yeah, maybe you'll find a different name than Gray Corps. But
I love that. And I wouldn't want people who wouldn't love that to join my group. It's like, wear it proudly. I'm an elder. You have to earn that. You can't buy it or train it. You have to live it. So I'm an elder.
Exactly.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah. So short of Gray Corps, I think there are a lot of really great groups doing this work at the local level, statewide level, and groups that are working on national issues but do have local chapters. So groups like the Sierra Club, that's a pretty
very active, very, group, very active, and very, local. Very important in the work in Arizona. Very.
Yes. So Sierra Club has chapters and groups in, I think, every state and covering most geographies in this country, which is pretty impressive. And then there are groups like Audubon Society, which is doing more and more work increasingly on climate change, actually. And
all of these groups need help. Like, I think about Nature Conservancy. Oh, yeah. They need volunteers. They need people to go help mm-hmm. them because everything's so underfunded. They need help with cleaning up and raking right. and you know, all right. of those basic things, volunteering in as docents for education. Mm-hmm. I mean, so, you know, my inspiration is always get involved with one of those because if you have a skill, they have a need. There are a myriad of organizations. And then there's Gray Corps. I'm never going to forget that, Annie, and maybe I'll live long enough to see it. But anyway, now I want to ask some personal questions. And don't be scared. But you have extensive background with some pretty powerful organizations like NRDC, Food and Water Watch, now what you're doing. What do you believe are some of the biggest threats we face? What are you afraid of, if anything, in terms of the 12 years ticking clock? You, Annie.
Yeah, great question. I am...
D, all of the above.
That's a big one. I guess I'm scared that we won't get our act together fast enough. There are so many great people...
Yep.
And institutions working really hard to advance change as quickly as they can. But again, I'll go back to something I said earlier, which is that I'm worried that it's going to take more and more significant natural disasters caused by climate change to get people to really wake up.
Lots of people are going to die. That's it.
Yeah.
And
that's what I'm worried about.
Read things like 60% of all species have disappeared from the planet since 1970, when I say that at a dinner party, people say, really? It's that bad? Right. I say, yes. Thus, the impact of humans on the planet, because they're not disappearing on their own. So it's just, I would say I agree with you, is that can we get there fast enough? And instead of being focused on that, you focus on solutions, as do I and our green team. It's like, yes, that's a thing. It's really there. But what can I do to be a part of turning this Earth ship around, as I call it, before it's really too late? And I was going to ask you what gives you the most hope, but you can hear it in your voice when you talk about these campaigns and you talk about what's happening with Tyson, the work you're doing and the impact you're seeing. I'm sure that's among the things that give you the most hope.
Absolutely. And I would add to that the people, too. The people that we train and work with every day are an immense source of inspiration as well. These are 22-year-olds, 23-year-olds right out of college who are passionate, they are talented, they are committed, and they want to make a difference. And they are going to do that with their lives. And they're here because they want the training and they want to learn how to launch a career doing this work. And so I sometimes feel like even though I'm 34, sometimes I feel like I've never left year 22 because I'm constantly surrounded by really passionate, inspired, and inspiring young people who are here to make a difference. And to me, that's as much as you can ask for.
It is, because they are our future and they're invested in it. So it's not the last question, but it's the last personal question, maybe. What are your thoughts on how to engage more people, wake them up and have them grasp the sense of urgency, but more importantly, make them aware of what they can do? Is there anything in the Annie head or experience that would say, Annie Sanders says, this is what we should do? This is what I have found to be effective.
Great question. I think the reason I've gravitated toward organizing as an approach to solving environmental problems is because it is so accessible. Everybody can be a part of it. You don't have to buy a Prius or buy organic food or spend resources. If you live here and you want to do something, you can sign a petition. You can make a phone call. You can write a letter to the editor. You can show up to a rally. You can get involved. And it's something that I think is really inspiring about organizing, is not only is it effective, but literally everybody can be a part of it and can be a part of the change. And so I think, to me, one of the biggest things we need to do more of, again, is give people those opportunities to get involved in political action and in organizing and in campaign work to affect real systemic change around environmental issues. Because the lifestyle activities that some people do have the ability to engage in are helpful, certainly. I mean, recycling is, that was a huge shift in the 90s when we actually got you know, most of the country on board with recycling. But at the end of the day, I think as Leonardo DiCaprio said at his address to the UN Climate Summit a few years ago, this has gone beyond the actions that individuals can take. We need governments and institutions to take large scale, decisive action. And so it's by getting involved in campaigns that are strategic and target real decision makers who can shift the balance of power. That's how we're going to have the biggest impact in the 12 years we've got.
And we just have to do it. So my last question before my last word or any last word you want to have, how can our listeners who might be inspired to act and decide to support your work take that step? What's your call to action for someone that says, I love this organization. How can I help them?
That is an excellent question.
Maybe the best question.
Well, I certainly have ideas for folks for how they can make an impact in their communities on these issues. And then in terms of Green Corps, I mean, we are a small and scrappy nonprofit. We make a lot happen with a little. We train, you know, anywhere from 10 to 25 organizers every single year. And we have, you know, we don't take any money from corporations or businesses. We have a few sources of income, one of which is foundations, one of which is our campaign partners, and another of which is individual donors. And the more that we are able to be supported by small individual donors or large individual donors, that enables us to do the recruitment and training work that we do and train even more young people to get out there, make an impact on critical campaigns, and graduate as alumni and launch careers in this line of work. And so our website is a great place to make donations. That is definitely a really, really critical way to help us be able to do the work that we do and expand our program. As generous as folks can be is really appreciated. And there's that. And there's also just mentioning Green Corps, referring people to Green Corps,
right,
and spreading the word about the program to, you know, folks who might want to do this work for a career or at least learn the skills to have an impact on critical campaigns. And so just talking about it and spreading the word is another really great way folks can help as well.
And if anybody wants to start Grey Corps, you can contact Annie or me, and you can find our information on the website. And I just want to remind everybody that anything that Annie refers to in terms of organizations or links, they'll all be on the show notes on our website. So when the podcast is up, you don't have to worry about writing anything down, because Kelly does an amazing job of putting links in of anything that we refer to. So, you know, we have, and I want to say also that no amount is too small. I think it's really important. We have a platform called Patreon where you can become a Mrs. Green's World member. And we value the $2 a month member as much as we value the $200 a month member, because it's all on scale of what people can afford. So for Green Corps, there's no amount that's too small. So don't think you have to be a $500,000 donor. You could do $5 a month.
Absolutely.
And boy, that helps with cash flow. Don't I know
it? Absolutely. Yep.
So the last word for Mrs. Green, and it's really a plea. The reality of climate change and its impact is here. And there is more and more evidence of it every single day. People are already starving because of flooding and droughts. People are already being displaced because of rising sea levels. Entire neighborhoods have been burned to the ground in a matter of days because of climate change. The rainforests continue to be destroyed at alarming rates. As I said earlier, 60% of all species on the planet have been destroyed since 1970. The worst thing you can possibly do is nothing. Get engaged, find your voices and raise them, and let's fight like hell to win this one. It's going to take all of us. So thank you for being a part of our world. And Annie, thank you and your team for all of the important pebble in the pond, ripple effect, and critical work you're doing to fight this good fight. It's been fun, delightful, and informative to spend this time with you. Thoroughly enjoyable.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for all the great work that you do for the environment.
Thank you so much. And I want to just talk about two shows coming up. On February 7th, our local show is with Martin Bay, Building a New Landfill, The Inside Scoop. I'm obsessed with landfills and how to build them properly and what all it takes to make sure that it's a safe landfill. So we're going to do that show. And on February 12th, a show that I've been looking forward to for about 2 years, Brenda Peterson, Wolf Nation, The Life, Death, and Return of the Wild American Wolves. Talk about a pack of people. Not kidding. The wolf people are really fighting the good fight to make sure that wolves do not go extinct in our country and in our time. So, Annie Sanders, thanks for crossing my path. Thanks for all the good work you do. And please help us spread the word by sharing this podcast far and wide.
Absolutely, will do. And thank you so much again for having me. It was a pleasure talking with you.